Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Good day, everyone. Welcome, and thank you for joining today's edition of Teneo Insights. I'm Kevin Kajiwara in New York City. China's annual parliament session, the National People's Congress, that ended this past weekend, marked the end of a series of meetings and documents, including the 20th Party Congress, the 14th Five-Year Plan, and the Central Economic Work Conference, which institutionalized the priorities of China and the Chinese Communist Party and solidified the positions of the country and party's leadership, not least Xi Jinping's third term as president and continued leadership of the party and the military. Meanwhile, relations with the United States continue to be dynamic, to say the least. While President Xi and President Biden attempted to put a floor under the deterioration of this most complex and most essential bilateral relationship, the balloon incident, the new select committee in Congress on China, and looming elections next year in both Taiwan and the United States suggest that relations are only going to become more complicated. So to help us understand these dynamics and other elements of Chinese foreign and economic policy, I'm joined today by three experts in the field. Ling Li is a teacher of politics and law at the University of Vienna and a non-resident fellow at NYU Law. She's an expert on Chinese law and politics, focusing on the party-state dynamic and the institutional practices of the Chinese Communist Party. She also writes extensively on Chinese law and is an expert on corruption and anti-corruption policies there as well. I'm happy to have Professor Li join us for the first time from Vienna, Austria today. My other guest will be familiar to many of you. Gabe Wildow is a Teneo Managing Director and he leads our coverage of China in the United States. He spent about 15 years in China, most recently as the Shanghai Bureau Chief of the Financial Times. And Paul Hanley joins from Singapore. He's Teneo's Chairman in the Asia Pacific region. He served in the Obama and George W. Bush White Houses as the China Director on the National Security Council. And he was the White House representative to the six-party nuclear talks. He was also a special assistant to the National Security Advisors, Condoleezza Rice and Steve Hadley. So thank you all for joining this morning. And let's jump right into it. And Professor Li, maybe I'll start with you. As I mentioned in the opening, you know, we've kind of come to the end of this long process, and there have been a lot of data points in there in both the meetings and the working documents that have come out of them. So, you know, I'd love to start with maybe an overview from you of your observations of how we should be interpreting this series of events and what, you know, China and its leadership is trying to show.
Okay, first of all, we need to understand a lot of leadership changes had been set at the 20th Party Congress, and what the Party Congress elects are memberships to the top decision-making bodies. That means it's almost like a qualification for top jobs, but it's not decided at that point of time which portfolio each member of these decision-making bodies will take. And many of that decisions are set afterwards. If it's a party position, then it can be set before the People's Congress. But if it involves any state positions, it has to be formalized at the People's Congress. And that's what happened 1 week ago. And when the Politburo Standing Committee members were determined at the 20th Party Congress, although there's no official designation of portfolio, but because the Politburo Standing Committee membership, there's a sequence of order. So usually there's a convention which position, depending on which position you are in, and that position is usually packed to a particular position in the state or in the party. And so we could already speculate which positions each member of the Politburo Standing Committee will be taking at that time. And that that estimation or assessment has been proved true, has been observed the old convention as is shown at the People's Congress. So we see the second position at the Politburo Standing Committee was taken by the Premier Li Qiang. And by the way, there's when I'm talking about convention and also the location position in the sequence of lineup at the Politburo Standing Committee, it's not always observed. For example, the sixth and seventh position, sometimes it might be reversed. Sometimes the sixth position is for the top of the CCDI, the party disciplinary institution, and the last position is for the first deputy premier of the state council. But sometimes it's reversed. So it's not 100% set in stones and things can change. But this time, the last convention has been largely observed, and Li Qiang was a premier, was elected as a premier, and Zhao Leji took the People's Congress, and Li Xi, that Li Xi's position was already determined at the Party Congress as a head of the CCDI, and the vice premier Ding Xueqiang, and also the head of the CCPPC, the Chinese People's Political Consultants Conference. So there's no surprise at all about the allocation of these positions. As to the lower positions, because they were taken by members of the Politburo and members of the Central Committee at the lower level. But when the Party Congress finished, those membership, there's no sequence of order. So we didn't know who is going to be appointed to which position. So there's no estimation. So we wouldn't be surprised because we cannot predict with reliable certainty. But in terms of the allocation of different seats at the Politburo level, we can see a measure of diversity. It's not all members from the Politburo are from Zhejiang or Fujian, which are the typical clique of Xi Jinping. We also have figures hailed from different parts of the country who does not seem to have an overlap in terms of working experience or place of origin with Xi Jinping. So it's quite diversified. It's not all Xi's men. However, at the Politburo Standing Committee, except the two persons who continued their Politburo Standing Committee membership from the last term, all the new promotions were Xi Jinping's people, either from Zhejiang or from Fujian. So that's on the front of personnel. In terms of the institutional reform, we know there has been a continuation of the institutional reform that started in 2018. This time, the scale of the institutional reform is a little bit smaller than the last time. Last time, it's implicated so many ministries and so many new commissions were established. And a lot of them were not changed. They stay where they were. But this time, there's significant changes regarding the regulation on the financial front. And there had been rumored proposal that there will be an internal interior commission, and the public security ministry and state security ministry will be taken out of the state council and put directly under the party. And that didn't happen because there's this rumor. So to give the rumor some credibility, I thought if there's no change regarding the state structure and the function of the Ministry of Public Security and internal state security, there might be some changes on the party front. For example, taking these two ministries out of the supervision from the political legal committee and put it in a different special committee, such as in interior commission. But that didn't happen either. I just received the new reform plan on both front party and the state, which were published like 40 minutes ago, and that didn't happen either. So the institutional reform seems quite controlled, and we can talk more about that later. But I believe it's more controlled and contained than many people were expecting. There's another major change of activity that took place at the People's Congress, which was the passage of an amendment of the legislative law. It's quite technical, but the major change is to allow the National People's Congress, in particular the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, to suspend certain laws, not only in specified region, but nationwide. That is also possible now, to suspend law and to experiment some kind of reform programs in the form of pilot projects. Previously, the party just do it. I mean, they just issue a directive by the National People's Congress. We're going to do a pilot project here or there, without regarding to the fact that the pilot project would violate the current legislation. But now there has been it's added to the legal system so that to put this kind of experimental reforms into the legal parameters, which is aligned to the rule on the to govern according to the law political project that has been advocated by Xi Jinping all the time since he took office 10 years ago.
So if I could just bring Paul Hanley in from Singapore for one moment, because I know, Paul, you just returned from a series of meetings in Washington. You are at the White House and you're meeting a lot of other foreign policy specialists and the like. And I'm just wondering, I want to follow up on Professor Lee's, you know, observations here, and A, ask you if that aligns with your interpretation, number one, but more importantly, is Washington viewing these changes in the way that Professor Lee is sort of interpreting?
Well, thanks, Kevin. And Professor Lee gave an excellent and very comprehensive overview. You know, the mood in Washington on China, broadly speaking, is quite negative these days. But I think it has more to do with the Chinese spy balloon incident and concerns over China potentially providing legal assistance to Russia than it does in terms of their concerns on the National People's Congress or the two meetings. I think on that aspect, I think most policymakers in the U.S. saw what Professor Lee said, which is a continuation of the trends that we've been seeing for quite a while, continuity coming out of the 20th Party Congress as well. And in that regard, what I mean in terms of trends are party wanting more say in government affairs and the State Council. Party in the past has really set direction, and then the State Council would carry out the implementation of that. And there used to be a strong division of work, but I think, you know, the trends that we're seeing is changes along those lines will continue. And I think it's fairly clear the trend for the party is to increasingly want more control over the state. And that, I think, is the view from Washington. There were some surprises, as Professor Lee pointed out. But overall, I think it's clear that those are the trends politically. Now, at the same time, it was also noticed that even while we see shifts in this regard and more emphasis on national security at the 20th Party Congress, it is clear that the Chinese Communist Party was also trying to send signals that it will remain focused on the economy as a central part of overall national strength. The economy is not in great shape. And in terms of the priorities that the leadership laid out at the National People's Congress, they seem to be quite pragmatic. Importance of the private sector, for example, wanting more to attract more foreign directed investment, to ensure national treatment for foreign companies. So, you know, these are, I think, received well by international businesses and investors. It's noteworthy that common prosperity agenda was in a sense downplayed. We also saw that the leadership kept on, the central bank governor, Egon, they kept on the finance and the commerce ministers as well. I think that reflects probably some anxiety in China among the leadership about keeping international companies and investors in the game. President Xi and the leadership do not want to see large-scale decoupling. They want to attract foreign investment, especially after 3 years of isolation and the current state of the economy. So I think those reappointments were probably intended to, in part, to reassure international markets. The institutional reforms that Professor Li mentioned on public security and state security that were quite controlled and contained, that may be a part of it as well, not wanting to spook the international community. But let me just conclude with this, because I think at the end of the day, there does seem to be some conflicting impulses at play. On one hand, you see the party projecting very pragmatic approach at the National People's Congress to economic affairs. On the other hand, it's clear that the party wants to further strengthen political and ideological control of the private sector and to make sure that economic management is in line with the party's priorities. So I think until the Chinese Communist Party is able to show foreign companies and investors more through their actions, really less rhetorically, how they plan to square that circle going forward, I think there's still going to be some uncertainty, some hesitation. China will hold the China Development Forum later this month, and there'll be a lot of multinational companies. Kevin, as you know, in fact, many of our clients will be there. Those CEOs are not blindly accepting the positive rhetoric from the MPC. They want to see real intentions behind the rhetoric, and they'll be looking for those signals at the China Development Forum later this month.
So Gabe, obviously the headlines coming out of the 20th Party Congress and since then have been that Xi Jinping had essentially, run the table, right? He had eliminated all opposition and was going to stack the major bodies, particularly the Standing Committee, with his loyalists. But this was evidenced in most dramatic fashion with the removal on camera of Hu Jintao from the meeting. But as Professor Li indicated in her earlier comments, in actuality, there's a greater amount of diversity amongst these men, and frankly, it is all men. And so I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on that. She spoke at Professor Li spoke at length about the new premier Li Qiang, obviously a longtime associate of Xi Jinping's, very closely associated with the extreme lockdowns in Shanghai during the pandemic. But I do wonder, he also is somebody who negotiated with Elon Musk to get the largest Tesla factory built in Shanghai. He was a political patron of the likes of Jack Ma and others. So talk a little bit about some of the diversity, or perhaps, moving away from the caricatures that we sometimes get of painting these men as all just sort of lockstep loyalists of President Xi.
Thanks, Kevin. I think one of the points that is missed in a lot of the discussion around these new leaders is the idea that they are simply yes men to Xi. Misses a lot of the picture insofar as, what we have in the key documents, the 14th five-year plan that you mentioned, the work reports from the Party Congress and the National People's Congress, is a very clear policy agenda. And it's as Professor Li and Paul both mentioned, it's a more of a balance between national security and economic growth. These individuals, including Li Qiang and the vice premiers that serve under him, they have a record of competence in their ability to execute those tasks and those objectives laid out in the report. So I think it would be a mistake to see these people as people who've just risen through the ranks because they are friendly with President Xi or because they're loyal to President Xi. These are men, and they are men, as you mentioned, who run some of China's largest and most economically developed provinces, Shanghai, Zhejiang, Fujian, and they have long experience dealing with foreign companies. And in fact, I've seen reports that in line with the focus this year in 2023 on really reviving growth after the damage from zero COVID, government officials, not just at the very top level, but provincial officials and sub-provincial officials have targets met for meeting with foreign business. There's a full court press on to emphasize the message that that the new Premier Li Qiang made at the National People's Congress and that President Xi has been emphasizing about support for foreign business and support for private business. And these are leaders who are capable of executing on that agenda. But we need to refer back to these documents to understand what the strategic long-term objectives are. And it's very clear now that economic growth is now only one of the top priorities rather than the top priority. So the competence question is less of an issue for me or less of a concern for me than simply what are the objectives. And we've heard a lot of talk about, you know, pragmatism. And, you know, when foreign analysts talk about, oh, is Li Qiang a pragmatist? Or these other vice premiers pragmatists, I think what they and we as foreign observers tend to mean by that term is sort of, you know, globalists has a sort of neoliberal outlook or a very pro economic growth outlook. And, you know, that's just no longer the agenda for China's top leadership. And so pragmatism in that context, in the Chinese context, means fulfilling the agenda laid out in those documents. And I do think they are pragmatic in that respect. It's just that the goals that they're pursuing are quite different. And for foreign business, you know, and the clients that Paul and I are advising, that's a concern, because even if the leadership succeeds in implementing that agenda, it may not be to the advantage of those businesses, at least to the same extent that it has been, you know, for most of the 2000s. And so the concern is less about competence and more about, you know, have the objectives changed?
So Professor Li, you know, notwithstanding the nuances and subtleties that you and Gabe and Paul have all just talked about in terms of the leadership, obviously there's an impression that has been given that, you know, that President Xi is the most powerful leader in China since Mao. And I wonder a couple of things from you after you've seen all of this play out. Maybe your assessment on just how strong he is. But secondly, you know, much has been made in the last year, particularly since the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, that it's a reminder that as sort of autocratic leaders extend their tenure in office, that the quality of decision making goes down, particularly as they eliminate more of the loyal opposition. They are surrounded more by people who owe their positions to that leader and the like, and that over time, then the quality of that decision making goes down. And that's a very fraught question when it comes to China, considering Taiwan, considering relations with the United States, considering the demographic challenges that the country is facing, and the issues around re-stimulating growth and the like. So I'm wondering what you think of Xi at this time and his position.
In terms of Xi Jinping's centralization of power or personalization of power, it certainly has achieved a lot during the last 10 years. And to give it a little bit of a context, in the Chinese political system, when the head of the party was elected to the office for the first term, you don't get to choose who you are going to work with. You don't have your own cabinet because the whole leadership composition is determined by your predecessor. You may have some role to play in that process, but you certainly don't have the final say, a major say in that decision-making process. So you have to work with people who were chosen by other people, not yourself. And usually you get the second term or the end of the second, when you have the control to nominate your own people to the cabinet, your term is going to finish up. According to by term, I don't necessarily mean the term limit because the party doesn't have a term limit, but by the age limit rule, which usually means you have two terms if the old rules were observed. So Xi Jinping has tried to break away from that, and that's what he has done in the last two terms to gain the opportunity that he has now to get his own cabinet. And also we can see, although the exact decision making behind the scenes, we don't know, we have very limited information about that, but from some fringe information or signals, we can already see how that has been played out. I'll give you one example. Previously, since Jiang Zemin's time, the decision-making process for the selection of national state leaders, which took place at the National People's Congress every 5 years, and two positions are very important in two positions are the first two positions in the steering committee at the National People's Congress when it convenes. And one, the first position is the incoming head of the National People's Congress. And the second position is also very important because that one will be in charge of the day-to-day organization of the Congress during that 2 weeks time. And since Jiang Zemin's time, that second position was held by a Politburo Standing Committee member consistently. Also during Hu Jintao's time, it has been changed when Xi Jinping, at the second term of Xi Jinping, because as I said, the first term, you don't have so much power. Everything was determined by your predecessor. You don't have control over the process. But from the 19th Party Congress and the People's Congress, following that Congress, the second seat of the steering committee of the People's Congress was taken by a member of the Central Secretariat, no longer by another Politburo Standing Committee member. And that person is usually the head of the Central Organization Department. So the 19th, the last People's Congress, it was Chen Xi, who also has the head of the Central Organization Department. And this time it's Li Ganjie, the one who's going to succeed Chen Xi as a head of the Central Organization Department. That means before that decision, I think they will be in charge of deciding certain positions for the state institutions, at least at the lower level, from the top, deputy premier, but ministry level and down. They will determine that. But previously it's two Politburo Standing Committee members, and now there's only one Politburo Standing Committee member and another person who's lower in ranking who will directly be answering to Xi Jinping himself. So from that normative point of view, Xi Jinping is taking more control of things. And now because he has his trusted person in those important positions, of functional departments, he can delegate those power to them and through them have a wider control of the process over a wider range of things. And we can see that consistently played out in different fields. For example, in the legal system, Chen Wenqing now at the Zhengfawei and Wang Xiaohong at the Ministry of Public Security. So he can delegate more since he has more of his people now have risen to the appropriate rank to take these positions. And through these people, he can reach to more sectors. Have close monitoring of these sectors. So from that point of view, he indeed has centralized power finally at the end of his second term.
And how do you, and then just to follow up on that, how do you feel that is going to impact the quality of his decision making, particularly on these like highly, highly critical and potentially consequential issues, such as U.S. relations, Taiwan relations, and the like?
It can go both ways. One way is if you have yes man and yes man only says yes. And the other way is because these people have a more trusting relationship with him, if they are yes men but with some characteristics or with character, they will be more emboldened to tell the truth, to say things that Xi Jinping probably wouldn't like to hear. If we give the story by Reuters any credibility that Li Qiang had contributed to the ending of the zero COVID policy, then that plays out as a second scenario. They're yes men, they're loyal, but they are also more emboldened to present the truth to the leader. So I think we need more information to make a conclusive assessment how that's going to be.
Paul, you want to do...
I was just going to jump in. I just wanted to say one thing. I agree with Professor Li very much that she's been very successful in consolidating his power. I don't think there's any obvious challenge to him at this point. And you mentioned, Kevin, you know, Hu Jintao being escorted out at the 20th Party Congress, and relatedly, the Chinese Youth League, or the Communist Youth League, the faction that he represents, frankly, being decimated at the 20th Party Congress. They may be out, the Communist Youth League. But, you know, China, we can't forget, China operates on a sort of a Guanxi, you know, relationship net and associated networks model. And the Guanxi network, the relationships network that political leaders build are important, and they ultimately can become factions in themselves. And so we talked about it, I think, on the last call. You know, these networks, these Guanxi networks involve deep bonds and personal obligations. Old factions die, generally new ones emerge. President Xi's anti-corruption campaign, you know, getting rid of, part of it is getting rid of potential rivals. I don't think that's dead. And I would not be surprised if we see going forward some very high level senior takedowns, even this year. Xi will want to get out in front of these new factions forming, certain Guanxi networks becoming too powerful. We saw him do this before in taking down the head of security, a standing committee member, former standing committee member, vice chairman of the Central Military Commission. Even Jack Ma, you know, represented a growing faction of sorts in the new technology sector, and he was taken out. So I think this will be important to watch going forward on this question. Again, I agree with Professor Li that Xi has done a, you know, considerable job in consolidating his power, but given that he is now clearly in charge and there's no one under him that, you know, I mean, certainly I take the point that they're not just, yeah, I don't like the phrase yes men. I don't think they're all yes men. I think they're capable leaders. I think they're smart and capable. And I do think that they will tell President Xi how they feel. But it does create a risk for President Xi that he has his political allies around him, because if policies go poorly, if the economy doesn't get going again, if the China-Russia strategic relationship turns out badly for him, he has no one to point to. He doesn't have a Li Keqiang anymore. And so the last point I'll make is, you know, Chinese leaders spend their entire career being paranoid. Frankly, I think they live their entire life being paranoid. So I think even with President Xi securing his third term, unprecedented, consolidating his power in a very strong way, I don't expect him to rest on his laurels or feel easy going forward.
Yeah. As Richard Nixon said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get you. So, but just I want to return to corruption in a few minutes here, Paul. But while I've got you, I wanted to pivot just a little bit and ask you, you know, about how you think this elite level politics then influences or impacts foreign policy coming out of China. Now, obviously, it was lost on no one that during Xi Jinping's speech and others at the People's Congress that he, in a rare departure, kind of called out the United States by name specifically, right? And accused the U.S. of all around containment, encirclement, and suppression of China. On the other hand, you know, we have seen some a pretty dramatic foray in the Middle East as China supposedly brokered the rapprochement, diplomatically at least, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And of course, there's the nature of this unlimited friendship, quote unquote, with Russia, and the risk that the United States is continuing to put out there that China, and you mentioned this earlier, that China may supply lethal weaponry to Russia and try to tilt the balance of the conflict. How do you see the foreign policy element playing out in the wake of the leadership changes and priorities laid out in the plans?
Well, I think we're seeing domestic politics play a pretty significant role in foreign policy, frankly, both in China and the United States. And we see that with the U.S. Select Committee on China, the bipartisan kind of approach to being much tougher on China. In China, I think you mentioned the statements that were made by President Xi for the first time, I think, calling out the United States for encircling and containing China. Normally, he says, some countries or unnamed countries. This was the first time he called it out, called the United States out. That's concerning, frankly, because, you can bet after these, national People's Congress meetings, the remarks that President Xi get studied at all levels by party committees and other organizations. And so this will send a signal that the U.S.-China, that it's time to be tough with the U.S. and push back with the U.S. So that's unfortunate. But, you can see the domestic politics, how it plays into foreign policy. I'll give you an example. If you read the statements that were made after Secretary Blinken and Wang Yi met at the Munich Security Conference, that will give you a big indication of how domestic politics plays into foreign policy. Both of the statements went through what each of the individuals said to the other. So, for example, Blinken's statement says that, he spoke to Wang Yi about the unacceptable violation of U.S. sovereignty, that, he warned Wang Yi about the implications of providing lethal assistance to Russia, and that he reiterated the U.S. will compete unapologetically. And the Chinese statement, first of all, it started out saying at the request of the U.S. side, Wang Yi met with Blinken. So they couldn't even, they needed to let it out there that they were meeting only because the U.S. side had asked for the meeting. But then, of course, it went through, Wang Yi, explained China's strong position on the balloon, and Wang Yi stressed, this issue, and he pointed out it was a regurgitation of what each gentleman said to the other. And I think in large part that is geared toward domestic audiences back in the United States and China. And we saw that from the beginning, frankly, at the Alaska meeting, when Secretary of State Blinken and Jake Sullivan met their counterparts in Alaska, the rhetoric and exchange was quite angry and heated. And of course that was in front of the media. And they knew that that would be played back home. And so in a sense, the audience was not in the room, it was back home. And that's why I think the outcome of the Biden's Xi summit in Bali in November was so important, because both of those leaders had the wind at their back coming out of their own domestic political events that allowed them to come into that meeting in a relatively strong position. Both leaders came in. Biden and the U.S. midterms, the Democrats, beat the historic trends, and Xi Jinping, as we said, ran the table at 20th Party Congress. So they used their relatively strong positions domestically to try to stabilize the relationship. We were on that path. Blinken's visit was a part of that effort, but the balloon incident and now these concerns over lethal assistance have created complications. The news that Speaker of the House McCarthy will not go to Taiwan this year, I think, is helpful. The chair of the Select Committee, Mike Gallagher, had suggested he would hold hearings on Taiwan. And then he visited secretly. didn't tell anybody until he returned, and when asked about hearings, said, well, they may do them on Guam. So, you know, there are indications that perhaps, you know, we have APEC, the U.S. is hosting APEC at the end of this year in the fall. And I suspect Biden will want President Xi there, and I suspect President Xi will want to be there himself. So that may be a forcing function mechanism that will allow our two leaders to try to put the relationship on better footing, despite the domestic politics in both capitals. But it's hard to tell at this point.
So I want to turn to Gabe and the economy here in just one moment. But because you brought up the balloon, I want to ask you one thing. You know, it was interesting to note yesterday, following the incident with the drone in the Black Sea, Secretary Austin, the Defense Secretary of the United States, had was quickly able to have a conversation with his counterpart in Russia, and it sort of demonstrated again that sort of the military to military relationship and contacts between the United States and Russia sort of remains on better footing than it does between the United States military and the Chinese military. And the balloon incident, although overall in the end sort of a benign situation, it did put on stark display that there is not a great institutionalized crisis management function between the United States and China. Is that a fair assessment, and is that concerning when you've got a lot more potentially more dangerous contact that could be made in the South and East China Seas?
I mean, look, from an American perspective, I find it concerning. From a broader perspective, I think the U.S. and China do want to avoid conflict, but it is difficult to set up these guardrails, crisis management mechanisms in the current environment. Outreach to the other side is often viewed in, as we said, in the domestic political environment in both countries as a sign of weakness. They see those almost as a tacit acceptance of U.S. military activity in the region, and they would rather the U.S. you know, pull back in terms of its military activity from the region. They don't want to give the U.S. military an out should the U.S. Military push the issue and have some crisis. So, you know, what they say is Chinese PLA will say, we don't want your military in China's backyard. So why would we want to establish these mechanisms to give you an out should something happen? And we can see the negative view towards these guardrails, as you say, during the balloon incident. The Chinese defense minister wouldn't answer Secretary of Defense Austin's phone call. So I think, you know, in the U.S. view, it's precisely during those difficult incidents like the balloon that these channels become critical. But we often see the Chinese, on the other hand, close down their communication channels instead. So even despite all that, I do think the Biden administration will continue to try to press the Chinese to implement more robust crisis management mechanisms, but I think it's going to be challenging.
Okay, so Gabe, so you know, I think you mentioned earlier in your remarks that there's been this kind of rebalancing over this last 6 month period of growth imperatives and market oriented economics with national security and communist ideology. And so, you know, we know that the new growth target has been put out there of around 5%, which sounds, you know, not all that exciting. We know that there are economic headwinds that the country is facing, and everything from the housing market to, you know, the fact that they've got to create something like 12 million new urban jobs this year. You've got 11.5 million college graduates from university in 2023, as an example. But we've also seen some data that the rebound coming out of the zero COVID period is pretty dramatic. So I guess, you know, what are your assessments of the economic policies coming out, as well as sort of the starting point that they've got to build off of from here? And there was a lot of rhetorical championing by the president and others, again, of the private sector. And I'm wondering how you're reading that.
I think this year is pivotal for perceptions of the Chinese economy over the next sort of 5 to 10 years among foreign investors in particular, because we're coming out of this zero COVID period, and we're coming out of this period of crackdowns on the housing sector and on the tech sector. And we're still in this period of political risk, geopolitical risk, which is definitely not going away. So the economy is crucial in terms of do foreign companies and foreign investors, are they willing to brave these political risks? Because if growth is strong, if growth is 5.5-6%, then it's worth it to brave the political risks because the market opportunity is still very strong. But if growth is weak, then why deal with the headaches, the political and geopolitical risks associated with doing business in China? And so that is why I think, you know, the short-term focus this year for policy is clearly on reviving growth. And but at the same time, I think Paul raised this question, you know, how far are they willing to back up the rhetoric about the private sector with action, and how much action really is necessary? Because what we've already seen is, I mean, a lot can be accomplished in terms of reviving growth simply by stop digging. You know, you've ended zero. So you're no longer crashing the economy, you know, more or less intentionally by the zero COVID policy and by these harsh controls on the housing sector and the crackdown on real estate. So how much growth can be revived simply by stopping what you were doing before versus you actually need to take more proactive steps to, you know, aggressively implement the kind of market reforms that Western economists have been advising for many years? That is a key question this year, is, you know, do animal spirits revive enough? Do the so-called revenge spending coming out of zero COVID carry the economy, you know, a long way towards maybe surpassing that 5% growth target? Do reversing the controls on the housing sector lead to a significant rebound in housing, or are we in a long-term, you know, slump of the housing sector due primarily to these demographic factors and the overbuilding of housing that's occurred over the last decade? So, you know, this is a hinge year, I think, for China's economy. The early data, over the last few months has been positive. And I think that 5% growth target will be met and most likely exceeded. That's what most economists are expecting. But there's a worry that, you know, once this initial wave of post-zero COVID consumer spending occurs and then starts to subside, you know, what are the more long-term growth drivers? Are they still in place to power, you know, growth well above 5%, not only this year, but in future years? And I think foreign investors are watching closely because, you know, there is a degree of pessimism among foreign investors and foreign businesses, but it's very hard to disentangle the sources of those pessimism between zero COVID, which is now over, the tech crackdown, which is now at least on hold, if not over. And so, you know, we will see where policymakers strike that balance between growth and other objectives like national security going forward. But, you know, a year from now, there's a scenario where the mood towards China among businesses is a lot different. If growth comes back, a lot of these geopolitical concerns, they're still going to exist, but it's just going to be viewed as a price of doing business rather than a reason to really pull back on China exposure.
And what do you think, Gabe? I mean, you know, another element here is that really for the first time since COVID, we've seen all of the all the visa restrictions going into China now starting to be lifted. So we're going to see a rush of American CEOs and other Western CEOs going back to China to sort of reinvigorate relationships, personal relationships in business and in government and elsewhere that had obviously atrophied over the last few years, like everybody's did. And they're going to have those face-to-face meetings again for the first time. What are they going to find, do you think? And I mean, because, you know, concurrent with everything we've been talking about, you know, the big rhetorical theme in when you look at the global economy has been decoupling and diversifying of supply chains and so on and so forth. Now, the data doesn't support that wholesale yet, obviously. But China obviously has something to sell here as well, right? I mean, that they have got economies of scale, they have got the sophistication of their logistics, they've got this incredibly sophisticated supply chain mechanism and network that has been built up over decades. That's not going to be replicated anywhere easily. So they've got something to sell. And it occurs to me that with Washington increasingly bipartisan in its hawkishness against China, that corporate America is seen as still somebody to do business with by the Chinese in terms of, you know, having a positive influence in Washington. So what do you think CEOs are going to encounter as they start to return to China for the first time?
I think they're going to encounter a message from Chinese officials that China is open for business, like we heard outgoing Premier Li Keqiang say, or excuse me, outgoing Vice Premier Liu He say at Davos. China is open for business. They're going to be re-emphasizing the advantages, the long-standing advantages I think we're all familiar with around supply chains, around, you know, high quality, the ability to do high quality manufacturing quickly and reliably. And you know, the implicit message that there's no replacement for us. You know, we're seeing marginal moves by the likes of Apple and Google to diversify away from China, but diversification is a lot different from replacement. And I think we're going to, I think the CEOs visiting China will hear that message from Chinese leaders that you know there's no one better than us at doing what we do, and that we're going to be a reliable supplier going forward, and that you know, we don't intend to cut you guys off. That if the risk is coming from your own governments, from Western governments that are pressuring you to decouple, and I don't know that they'll say this message directly, but the implied message from Chinese officials is going to be, we need you to push back against the political trends in your home governments towards decoupling, because it's bad for the world. Globalization is good, and you've benefited from globalization. We've benefited from it. We want it to continue, and we're going to treat you well. We're going to create a growth environment that allows you to prosper. Now, of course, that message will be greeted with a degree of skepticism. But as I said before, I think, you know, the growth story overall in China will tell the tale. It will go a lot further than any of those assurances from government officials that China, it's worth staying in China. So, you know, and they'll say that, you know, zero COVID is over. It was, I mean, future pandemics could come, but the supply chain disruptions associated with zero COVID, you know, aren't as much of a concern going forward because that's all in the past.
So, Professor Li, both Paul and Gabe have brought up the issue of corruption, and I want to ask you, because I know you've done a lot of work on this in your career, and I want to ask you about it in the context of what Gabe was just talking about. We have seen these kind of crackdowns sort of move from industry to industry, and I'm wondering if it is if there's a particular reason for focusing. Is it just sort of it's time to focus on this industry and clean it out, and then focus on this industry and clean it out? And I'm wondering if there are sometimes issues of whether the right hand knows what the left hand is doing, because you get these sort of mixed messages. To Gabe's point about Liu He's speech at Davos and whatnot, that we are open for business, and the lifting of the crackdown on the tech sector. At the same time, then we have the disappearance of Baofan, the investment banker, best known in the West, investment banker, best known for his technology-related deals and whatnot, just sort of disappearing, which would seem to send a more of a chilling effect again at the same time, in contrast with that more welcoming rhetoric. So how should we interpret the anti-corruption moves, and specifically around the disappearance of Baofan?
Yeah. Baofan is an individual case. I don't think it necessarily negates the trend of welcoming gesture that Liu He is trying to signal to the rest of the world. And there's one thing that has caught my attention in anti-corruption activities in the last couple of years, which is increasing concern on the side of the party about the politicians or politics being captured by the business group, which is probably quite common in Western democracies, where you need money to finance political campaigns so that the business group who supports one particular politician can have a lot of say which exactly politician they want to support. But in China, it has never been the case, because the business, they don't have real political power. They can collude with the politician, but all the political matters, including personnel matters, it's decided by the party in a very top-down fashion. And I think there has been, I don't have cases to substantiate that, but I believe the party has seen cases where business groups trying to shape the personnel decisions, either at the local, regional, or even central level, because it has been mentioned in different party policy documents in terms of anti-corruption, and has been repeatedly mentioned, and it's even written in the television shows about politicians, about businessmen trying to nominate their own candidates for certain political posts. That's something I think the party is really concerned and alerted about. And the party has identified certain sectors, as you said. The first sector is the financial sector, and then also Zhengfa, the political legal institutions, grain supplies. These sectors will be the focus for the next round of anti-corruption campaign, including the anti-corruption agencies themselves. So they need a self-cleaning of the CCDI because it has grown so powerful in the last 10 years. I think a campaign on itself is called for. Why it has been moving from one sector to another one? I think it's like all party campaigns, which is you mobilize resources and focus all the mobilized resources in one particular target so that you can generate a higher deterrence level by bumping up the arrest and conviction rate, and you have limited resources. And if you spread out in all sectors, one is impact will be too wide, too systematic, and may paralyze the government. And second, you will thin out the investigative resources. So it makes sense for them to focus on one sector and then move on to another.
So I've got to land the plane here, Paul. Let me give the last word to you here. I don't want to turn back to the U.S. You know, notwithstanding the fact that the U.S. government right now seems to be very, very focused on the challenges in the banking sector in the U.S. and potentially in Europe. But nonetheless, you know, it's not lost on anyone. The news headlines last night as well about TikTok. And the U.S. demand that that TikTok either be divested or could get banned. And you know, you mentioned the Select Committee on China, and notwithstanding perhaps that the chairman has been you know, downplayed the trip to Taiwan a little bit, and so on and so forth. You know, those hearings are going to continue. What do you see next out of U.S. policy?
Yeah, so I think the key thing to look at going forward in terms of foreign policy, of course, is what happens with respect to China, these concerns about China providing lethal assistance to Russia. I think this is a very, let me say this way, I think the U.S. government sees it as a very serious issue at a time where, you know, there's been a lot of effort, as you know, and a lot of money and a lot of support given by the U.S. and Europe to try to help Ukraine defend itself. If China moves forward in some way, and there's some indications that they might try to do it through a third party, they may try to cover it up so that it's not seen, and there's ways that they can do that. But if it's discovered, if it's identified, and it can be proven, and this is an issue too, because for the Chinese at the end of the day, what they need is really just plausible deniability. But if it comes to be that China takes this decision to do that, I think you're going to see, I feel like Capitol Hill is spring loaded to launch sanctions on China. They'll work with European partners to do the same. And you'll see a setup where you've got the US and Europe on one side helping Ukraine, and this is what I heard in DC when I was there, in a sense a proxy war with China. The facade of being neutral on Ukraine would go away and clearly would align with Russia. That is of concern, and I think is of significant concern. If we can avoid that, I laid out a scenario where we've got APEC by the end of the year and maybe the two sides can find a better footing. U.S. Select Committee will continue its work. And you know, we saw the first hearing in prime time, and I think they'll continue to move forward. I think the key question for me in the for the committee. Is it going to be mostly for political show, or is the committee going to find a way to be helpful in providing useful and constructive examination of U.S.-China relations that ultimately results in more effective foreign policy down the road? That should be the goal. But again, we're talking about Capitol Hill, and as you saw, the first session was in prime time. So we may see more of the of these hearings. They'll be, you know, they may be sensational in watching them. But we need to, as a country, work with our partners abroad. We need to deal with the challenges in a way, frankly, to defend and advance U.S. interests. And that should be the focus of U.S. Select Committee on China. But we'll see going forward.
My final question for you, Paul, then, is this. What are you advising, or what would your general advice be then to corporate leaders who, as we talked about, are probably going to be encouraged and need for their business purposes to get back to China soon? But, you know, being seen as overly friendly with China could get you hauled in front of that select committee to testify. How do you thread that needle effectively? Got to be pretty fraught.
Yeah, I think the challenge is, you know, as one CEO said to me recently, and I think I shared this with you, you know, CEOs used to be able to, you know, just know their business, you know their customers well, and could be successful. In this day and age, if the geopolitics is really having a huge impact on what they do, and so you've got to track these developments and then develop strategies to try to thread the needle. It's getting increasingly more difficult, especially in the U.S.-China context. And we saw that recently when the U.S. ambassador went to the American Chamber of Commerce, you know, annual gala dinner, gave a speech, and then the Chinese Global Times wrote an article saying that members of the American Chamber of Commerce staff were embarrassed by U.S. ambassador's wolf warrior rhetorics. So, you know, that there's an attempt to kind of drive a wedge, in a sense, between the U.S. business community and the U.S. government actions. And so it's going to continue to get trickier and trickier, and you got to track it, follow these issues closely, and develop strategies to deal with those challenges.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachiwara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.